did, for my deeds do not argue anything else. But for all that, I would have you take notice that I am neither so mad nor so foolish as I must have seemed to you. A gallant knight shows to advantage bringing his lance to bear adroitly upon a fierce bull under the eyes of his sovereign, in the midst of a spacious plaza. A knight shows to advantage, arrayed in glittering armour, pacing the lists before the ladies in some joyous tournament, and all those knights show to advantage that entertain, divert, and, if we may say so, honour the courts of their princes by warlike exercises or what resemble them. But to greater advantage than all these does a knight-errant show, when he traverses deserts, solitudes, crossroads, forests, and mountains, in quest of perilous adventures, bent on bringing them to a happy and successful issue, all to win a glorious and lasting renown. To greater advantage, I maintain, does the knight-errant show bringing aid to some widow in some lonely waste than the court knight dallying with some city damsel. All knights have their own special parts to play. Let the courtier devote himself to the ladies, let him add lustre to his sovereign's court by his liveries, let him entertain poor gentlemen with the sumptuous fare of his table, let him arrange joustings, martial tournaments, and prove himself noble, generous, and magnificent, and above all, a good Christian. And so doing he will fulfil the duties that are especially his. But let the knight-errant explore the corners of the earth, and penetrate the most intricate labyrinths. At each step let him attempt impossibilities. On desolate heaths let him endure the burning rays of the midsummer sun, and the bitter inclemency of the winter winds and frosts. Let no lions daunt him, no monsters terrify him, no dragons make him quail. For to seek these, to attack those, and to vanquish all, are in truth his main duties. I, then, as it has fallen to my lot to be a member of knight-errantry, cannot avoid attempting all that to me seems to come within the sphere of my duties. Thus it was my bounden duty to attack those lions that I just now attacked, although I knew it to be the height of rashness. For I know well what valour is, that it is a virtue that occupies a place between two vicious extremes, cowardice and temerity. But it will be a lesser evil for him who is valiant to rise till he reaches the point of rashness than to sink until he reaches the point of cowardice. For as it is easier for the prodigal than for the miser to become generous, so it is easier for a rash man to prove truly valiant than for a coward to rise to true valour. And believe me, Señor Don Diego, in attempting adventures it is better to lose by a card too many than by a card too few. For to hear it said, such a knight is rash and daring, sounds better than such a knight is timid and cowardly. I protest, Señor Don Quixote, said Don Diego, everything you have said and done is proved correct by the test of reason itself. And I believe if the laws and ordinances of knight-errantry should be lost, they might be found in your worship's breast as in their own proper depository and muniment house. But let us make haste and reach my village, where you shall take rest after your late exertions, for if they have not been of the body, they have been of the spirit, and these sometimes tend to produce bodily fatigue. I take the invitation as a great favour and honour, Señor Don Diego, replied Don Quixote. And pressing forward at a better pace than before, at about 2 in the afternoon, they reached the village and house of Don Diego, or, as Don Quixote called him, the Knight of the Green Gaban. Part 2 Chapter 18 Of what happened to Don Quixote in the castle or house of the Knight of the Green Gaban, together with other matters out of the common. Don Quixote found Don Diego de Miranda's house built in village style, with his arms in rough stone over the street door. In the patio was the storeroom, and at the entrance the cellar, with plenty of wine jars standing around, which, coming from El Toboso, brought back to his memory his enchanted and transformed Dulcinea. And with a sigh, and not thinking of what he was saying or in whose presence he was, he exclaimed, "Oh, ye sweet treasures to my sorrow found! Once sweet and welcome when 'twas heaven's good will. O ye Tobosan jars, how ye bring back to my memory the sweet object of my bitter regrets." The student poet, Don Diego's son, who had come out with his mother to receive him, heard this exclamation, and both mother and son were filled with amazement at the extraordinary figure he presented. He, however, dismounting from Rocinante, advanced with great politeness to ask permission to kiss the lady's hand, while Don Diego said, "Señora, pray receive with your wonted kindness Señor Don Quixote of La Mancha, who you see before you, a knight-errant, and the bravest and wisest in the world." The lady, whose name was Doña Cristina, received him with every sign of goodwill and great courtesy, and Don Quixote placed himself at her service with an abundance of well-chosen and polished phrases. Almost the same civilities were exchanged between him and the student, who, listening to Don Quixote, took him to be a sensible, clear-headed person. Here the author describes minutely everything belonging to Don Diego's mansion, putting before us in his picture the whole contents of a rich gentleman farmer's house. But the translator of the history thought it best to pass over these and other details of the same sort in silence, as they are not in harmony with the main purpose of the story, the strong point of which is truth rather than dull digressions. They led Don Quixote into a room, and Sancho removed his armour, leaving him in loose walloon breeches and chamois leather doublet, all stained with the rust of his armour. His collar was a falling one of the scholastic cut, without starch or lace. His leggings buff-coloured, and his shoes polished. He wore his good sword, which hung in a baldric of sealskin, for he had suffered for many years, they say, from an ailment of the kidneys, and over all he threw a long cloak of good grey cloth. But first of all, with 5 or 6 buckets of water, for as regard the number of buckets there is some dispute, he washed his head and face, and still the water remained whey-coloured, thanks to Sancho's greediness and purchase of those unlucky curds that turned his master so white. Thus arrayed, and with an easy, sprightly, and gallant air, Don Quixote passed out into another room where the student was waiting to entertain him while the table was being laid, for on the arrival of so distinguished a guest, Doña Cristina was anxious to show that she knew how and was able to give a becoming reception to those who came to her house. While Don Quixote was taking off his armour, Don Lorenzo, for so Don Diego's son was called, took the opportunity to say to his father, "What are we to make of this gentleman you've brought home to us, sir? For his name, his appearance, and your describing him as a knight-errant have completely puzzled my mother and me."
"I don't know what to say, son," replied Don Diego. "All I can tell thee is that I have seen him act the acts of the greatest madman in the world, and heard him made observations so sensible that they efface and undo all he does. Do thou talk to him, and feel the pulse of his wits, and as thou art shrewd, form the most reasonable conclusion thou canst as to his wisdom or folly. Though, to tell the truth, I am more inclined to take him to be mad than sane."
With this, Don Lorenzo went away to entertain Don Quixote, as has been said, and in the course of the conversation that passed between them, Don Quixote said to Don Lorenzo,
"Your father, Señor Don Diego de Miranda, has told me of the rare abilities and subtle intellect you possess, and, above all, that you are a great poet."
"A poet it may be," replied Don Lorenzo, "but a great one by no means. It is true that I am somewhat given to poetry and to reading good poets, but not so much as to justify the title of great which my father gives me."
"I do not dislike that modesty," said Don Quixote, "for there is no poet who is not conceited and does not think he is the best poet in the world."
"There is no rule without an exception," said Don Lorenzo. "There may be some who are poets, and yet do not think they are."
"Very few," said Don Quixote. "But tell me, what verses are those which you have now in hand, and which your father tells me keep you somewhat restless and absorbed? If it be some gloss, I know something about glosses, and I should like to hear them. And if they are for a poetical tournament, contrive to carry off the second prize. For the first always goes by favour or personal standing, the second by simple justice. And so the third comes to be the second, and the first, reckoning in this way, will be third, in the same way as university degrees are conferred. But for all that, the title of first is a great distinction."
"So far," said Don Lorenzo to himself, "I should not take you to be a madman, but let us go on."
So he said to him, "Your worship has apparently attended the schools. What sciences have you studied?"
"'That of knight-errantry,' said Don Quixote, "'which is as good as that of poetry, and even a finger or two above it.'
"'I do not know what science that is,' said Don Lorenzo, "'and until now I have never heard of it.'
"'It is a science,' said Don Quixote, "'that comprehends in itself all or most of the sciences in the world. "'For he who professes it must be a jurist, and must know the rules of justice, "'distributive and equitable, so as to give each one what belongs to him and is due to him.' He must be a theologian, so as to be able to give a clear and distinctive reason for the Christian faith he professes, wherever it may be asked of him. He must be a physician, and above all a herbalist, so as in wastes and solitudes to know the herbs that have the property of healing wounds, for a knight-errant must not go looking for someone to cure him at every step. He must be an astronomer, so as to know by the stars how many hours of the night have passed, and what clime and quarter of the world he is in. He must know mathematics. For at every turn some occasion for them will present itself to him. And, putting it aside that he must be adorned with all the virtues, cardinal and theological, to come down to minor particulars, he must, I say, be able to swim as well as Nicholas or Nicolau the fish could, as the story goes. He must know how to shoe a horse and repair his saddle and bridle, and, to return to higher matters, he must be faithful to God and to his lady. He must be pure in thought, decorous in words, generous in works, valiant in deeds, patient in suffering, compassionate towards the needy, and lastly, an upholder of the truth, though its defence should cost him his life. Of all these qualities, great and small, is a true knight-errant made up. Judge then, Señor Don Lorenzo, whether it be a contemptible science which the knight who studies and professes it has to learn, and whether it may not compare with the very loftiest that are taught in the schools.
"'If that be so,' replied Don Lorenzo, "'this science, I protest, surpasses all.'
"'How, if that be so?' said Don Quixote.
"'What I mean to say,' said Don Lorenzo, "'is... that I doubt whether there are now, or ever were, any knights-errant and adorned with such virtues.
"'Many a time,' replied Don Quixote, "'have I said what I now say once more, "'that the majority of the world are of opinion "'that there never were any knights-errant in it. "'And as it is my opinion that, "'unless heaven by some miracle brings home to them "'the truth that there were and are, "'all the pains one takes will be in vain, as experience has often proved to me. "'I will not now stop to disabuse you of the error you share with the multitude. "'All I shall do is to pray to heaven to deliver you from it, "'and show you how beneficial and necessary knights-errant were in days of yore, "'and how useful they would be in these days, were they but in vogue. "'But now, for the sins of the people, sloth and indolence, "'gluttony and luxury are triumphant.'
"'Our guest has broken out on our hands,' said Don Lorenzo to himself at this point. "'But for all that, he is a glorious madman, and I should be a dull blockhead to doubt it.' Here, being summoned to dinner, they brought their colloquy to a close. Don Diego asked his son what he had been able to make out as to the wits of their guest, to which he replied, "'All the doctors and clever scribes in the world will not make sense of the scrawl of his madness. He is a madman full of streaks.' "'Full of lucid intervals. "'They went in to dinner, and the repast was such as Don Diego said on the road "'he was in the habit of giving to his guests, "'neat, plentiful, and tasty. "'But what pleased Don Quixote most "'was the marvellous silence that reigned throughout the house, "'for it was like a Carthusian monastery. "'When the cloth had been removed, Grace said, and their hands washed, Don Quixote earnestly pressed Don Lorenzo to repeat to him his verses for the poetical tournament, to which he replied, "'Not to be like those poets who, when they are asked to recite their verses, refuse, and when they are not asked for them, vomit them up, I will repeat my gloss, for which I do not expect any prize, having composed it merely as an exercise of ingenuity.' "'A discerning friend of mine,' said Don Quixote, "'was of opinion that no one ought to waste labour in glossing verses, "'and the reason he gave was that the gloss can never come up to the text, "'and that often, or most frequently, it wanders away from the meaning and purpose aimed at in the glossed lines, "'and besides, that the laws of the gloss were too strict, as they did not allow interrogations, "'nor said he, nor I say, nor turning verbs into nouns or altering the construction, "'not to speak of other restrictions and limitations that fetter gloss writers.' as you no doubt know. "Verily, Señor Don Quixote," said Don Lorenzo, "I wish I could catch your worship tripping at a stretch, but I cannot, for you slip through my fingers like an eel."
"I don't understand what you say, or mean by slipping," said Don Quixote.
"I will explain myself another time," said Don Lorenzo. "For the present, pray attend to the glossed verses and the gloss, which run thus. Could was become an is for me, then would I ask no more than this. Or could, for me, the time that is become the time that is to be."
Gloss. Dame Fortune once upon a day to me was bountiful and kind. But all things change, she changed her mind, and what she gave she took away. Oh, Fortune, long I've sued to thee, the gifts thou gavest me restore, for trust me, I would ask no more could was become an is for me. No other prize I seek to gain, no triumph, glory, or success, only the long-lost happiness, the memory whereof is pain. One taste, methinks, of bygone bliss, the heart-consuming fire might stay. And so it come without delay, then would I ask no more than this.
I ask what cannot be, alas, that time should ever be and then come back to us and be again no power on earth can bring to pass. For fleet of foot is he, I wis, and idly therefore do we pray that what for aye hath left us may become for us the time that is. Perplexed, uncertain to remain twixt hope and fear is death, not life. 'Twere better sure to end the strife, and dying seek release from pain. And yet thought were the best for me. Anon the thought aside I fling, and to the present fondly cling, and dread the time that is to be.
When Don Lorenzo had finished reciting his gloss, Don Quixote stood up, and in a loud voice, almost a shout, exclaimed as he grasped Don Lorenzo's right hand in his,
"By the highest heavens, noble youth, but you are the best poet on earth, and deserve to be crowned with laurel, not by Cyprus or by Gaeta, as a certain poet, God forgive him, said, but by the academies of Athens, if they still flourished, and by those that flourish now, Paris, Bologna, Salamanca. Heaven grant that the judges who rob you of the first prize, that Phoebus may pierce them with his arrows, and the muses never cross the thresholds of their doors. Repeat me some of your long-measure verses, senor, if you will be so good, for I want thoroughly to feel the pulse of your rare genius."
Is there any need to say that Don Lorenzo enjoyed hearing himself praised by Don Quixote, albeit he looked upon him as a madman?
"Power of flattery, how far-reaching art thou, and how wide are the bounds of thy pleasant jurisdiction!"
Don Lorenzo gave a proof of it, for he complied with Don Quixote's request and entreaty, and repeated to him this sonnet on the fable or story of Pyramus and Thisbe. Sonnet. The lovely maid, she pierces now the wall. Heart pierced by her, young Pyramus doth lie, and love spreads wing from Cyprus isle to fly, a chink to view so wondrous, great and small. There silence speaketh, for no voice at all can pass so straight a strait, but love will ply where to all other power 'twere vain to try. For love will find a way whate'er befall. Impatient of delay, with reckless pace the rash maid wins the fatal spot, where she sinks not in lover's arms, but death's embrace. So runs the strange tale, how the lovers twain one sword, one sepulchre, one memory slays and entombs and brings to life again.
"Blessed be God," said Don Quixote when he had heard Don Lorenzo's sonnet, "that among the hosts there are of irritable poets, I have found one consummate one, which, senor, the art of this sonnet proves to me that you are."
For 4 days was Don Quixote most sumptuously entertained in Don Diego's house, at the end of which time he asked his permission to depart, telling him he thanked him for the kindness and hospitality he had received in his house. But that, as it did not become knights errant to give themselves up for long to idleness and luxury, he was anxious to fulfil the duties of his calling in seeking adventures, of which he was informed there was an abundance in that neighbourhood, where he hoped to employ his time until the day came round for the jousts at Saragossa, for that was his proper destination,
and that, first of all, he meant to enter the cave of Montesinos, of which so many marvellous things were reported all through the country, and at the same time to investigate and explore the origin and true source of the seven lakes commonly called the Lakes of Ruidera. Don Diego and his son commended his laudable resolution, and bade him furnish himself with all he wanted from their house and belongings, as they would most gladly be of service to him, which indeed his personal worth and his honourable profession made incumbent upon them. The day of his departure came at length, as welcome to Don Quixote as it was sad and sorrowful to Sancho Panza, who was very well satisfied with the abundance of Don Diego's house, and objected to return to the starvation of the woods and wilds, and the short commons of his ill-stocked saddle-bags. These, however, he filled and packed with what he considered needful. On taking leave, Don Quixote said to Don Lorenzo, "I know not whether I have told you already, but if I have to tell you once more that if you wish to spare yourself fatigue and toil in reaching the inaccessible summit of the Temple of Fame, you have nothing to do but to turn aside out of the somewhat narrow path of poetry, and take the still narrower one of knight-errantry, wide enough, however, to make you an emperor in the twinkling of an eye." In this speech, Don Quixote wound up the evidence of his madness, but still better in what he added when he said, "God knows I would gladly take Don Lorenzo with me to teach him how to spare the humble and trample the proud underfoot, virtues that are part and parcel of the profession I belong to. But since his tender age does not allow of it, nor his praiseworthy pursuits permit it, I will simply content myself with impressing it upon your worship that he will become famous as a poet, if he is guided by the opinion of others rather than by his own, because no fathers or mothers ever think their own children ill-favoured, and this sort of deception prevails still more strongly in the case of the children of the brain." Both father and son were amazed afresh at the strange medley Don Quixote talked, at one moment sense, at another nonsense, and at the pertinacity and persistence he displayed in going through thick and thin in quest of his unlucky adventures, which he made the end and aim of his desires. There was a renewal of offers of service and civilities, and then, with the gracious permission of the lady of the castle, they took their departure, Don Quixote on Rocinante and Sancho on Dapple. Chapter 19. In which is related the adventure of the enamoured shepherd, together with other truly droll incidents. Don Quixote had gone but a short distance beyond Don Diego's village, when he fell in with a couple of either priests or students, and a couple of peasants, mounted on four beasts of the ass kind. One of the students carried, wrapped up in a piece of green buckram by way of a portmanteau, what seemed to be a little linen and a couple of pairs of ribbed stockings. The other carried nothing but a pair of new fencing foils with buttons. The peasants carried diverse articles that showed they were on their way from some large town where they had bought them, and were taking them home to their village. And both students and peasants were struck with the same amazement that everybody felt who first saw Don Quixote for the first time, and were dying to know who this man, so different from ordinary men, could be. Don Quixote saluted them, and after ascertaining that their road was the same as his, made them an offer of his company, and begged them to slacken their pace, as their young asses travelled faster than his horse. And then, to gratify them, he told them in a few words who he was and the calling and profession he followed, which was that of a knight-errant seeking adventures in all parts of the world. He informed them that his own name was Don Quixote of La Mancha, and that he was called, by way of surname, the Knight of the Lions. All this was Greek or gibberish to the peasants, but not so to the students, who very soon perceived the crack in Don Quixote's pate. For all that, however, they regarded him with admiration and respect, and one of them said to him, "If you, Sir Knight, have no fixed road, as it is the way with those who seek adventures not to have any, let your worship come with us. You will see one of the finest and richest weddings that up to this day have ever been celebrated in La Mancha, or for many a league round." Don Quixote asked him if it was some princes that he spoke of it in this way. "Not at all," said the student. "It is the wedding of a farmer and a farmer's daughter, he the richest in all this country, and she the fairest mortal ever set eyes on. The display with which it is to be attended will be something rare and out of the common, for it will be celebrated in a meadow adjoining the town of the bride, who is called, par excellence, Quiteria the Fair, as the bridegroom is called Camacho the Rich. She is 18 and he 22, and they are fairly matched, though some knowing ones, who have all the pedigrees in the world by heart, will have it that the family of the fair Quiteria is better than Caraccio's. But no one minds that nowadays, for wealth can solder a great many flaws. At any rate, Camacho is free-handed, and it is his fancy to screen the whole meadow with boughs and cover it in overhead, so that the sun will have hard work if he tries to get in to reach the grass that covers the soil. He has provided dancers, too, not only sword but also bell dancers, for in his own town there are those who ring the changes and jingle the bells to perfection. Of shoe dancers I say nothing, for of them he has engaged a host. But none of these things, nor of the many others I have omitted to mention, will do more to make this a memorable wedding than the part which I suspect the despairing Basilio will play in it. This Basilio is a youth of the same village as Quiteria, and he lived in the house next door to that of her parents, of which circumstance love took advantage to reproduce to the word the long-forgotten loves of Pyramus and Thisbe. For Basilio loved Quiteria from his earliest years, and she responded to his passion with countless modest proofs of affection, so that the loves of the two children, Basilio and Quiteria, were the talk and the amusement of the town. As they grew up, the father of Quiteria made up his mind to refuse Basilio his wonted freedom of access to the house, and to relieve himself of constant doubts and suspicions, he arranged a match for his daughter with the rich Camacho, as he did not approve of marrying her to Basilio, who had not so large a share of the gifts of fortune as of nature. For if the truth be told ungrudgingly, he is the most agile youth we know, a mighty thrower of the bar, a first-rate wrestler, and a great ball-player. He runs like a deer, and leaps better than a goat, bowls over the ninepins as if by magic, sings like a lark, plays the guitar so as to make it speak, and above all, handles a sword as well as the best. "For that excellence alone," said Don Quixote at this, "the youth deserves to marry not merely the fair Quiteria, but Queen Guinevere herself, were she alive now, in spite of Lancelot and all who would try to prevent it." "Say that to my wife," said Sancho, who had until now listened in silence, "for she won't hear of anything but each one marrying his equal, holding with the proverb, 'Each you to her like.' What I would like is that this good Basilio, for I'm beginning to take a fancy to him already, should marry this lady Quiteria. And a blessing and good luck, I'm meant to say the opposite, on people who would prevent those who love one another from marrying." "If all those who love one another were to marry," said Don Quixote, "it would deprive parents of the right to choose and marry their children to the proper person and at the proper time. And if it was left to daughters to choose husbands as they pleased, one would be for choosing her father's servant, and another someone she has seen passing in the street and fancies gallant and dashing, though he may be a drunken bully. For love and fancy easily blind the eyes of the judgment, so much wanted in choosing one's way of life. And the matrimonial choice is very liable to error, and it needs great caution and the special favour of heaven to make it a good one. He who has to make a long journey will, if he is wise, look out for some trusty and pleasant companion to accompany him before he sets out. Why, then, should not he do the same who has to make the whole journey of life down to the final halting-place of death, more especially when the companion has to be his companion in bed, at board, and everywhere, as the wife is to her husband? The companionship of one's wife is no article of merchandise, that after it has been bought may be returned or bartered or changed, for it is an inseparable accident that lasts as long as life lasts. It is a noose that once you put it round your neck turns into a Gordian knot, which if the scythe of death does not cut it, there is no untying. I could say a great deal more on this subject, were I not prevented by the anxiety I feel to know if the Señor Licentiate has anything more to tell about the story of Basilio. To this the student, bachelor, or, as Don Quixote called him, licentiate, replied, "I have nothing whatever to say further, but that from the moment Basilio learned that the fair Quiteria was to be married to Camacho the rich, he has never been seen to smile or heard to utter a rational word, and he always goes about moody and dejected, talking to himself in a way that shows plainly he is out of his senses. He eats little and sleeps little, and all he eats is fruit, and when he sleeps, if he sleeps at all, it is in the field on the hard earth like a brute beast. Sometimes he gazes at the sky, at other times he fixes his eyes on the earth in such an abstracted way that he might be taken for a clothed statue with its drapery stirred by the wind.
In short, he shows such signs of a heart crushed by suffering that all we who know him believe that when tomorrow the fair Quiteria says yes, it will be his sentence of death.
God will guide it better, said Sancho, for God who gives the wound gives the salve. Nobody knows what will happen. There are a good many hours between this and tomorrow, and any one of them, or any moment, the house may fall. I have seen the rain coming down and the sun shining all at one time. Many a one goes to bed in good health who can't stir the next day. And tell me, is there any one who can boast of having driven a nail into the wheel of fortune? No, faith. And between a woman's yes and no, I wouldn't venture to put the point of a pin, for there would not be room for it. If you tell me Quiteria loves Basilio heart and soul, then I'll give him a bag of good luck. For love, as I have heard say, looks through spectacles that make copper seem gold, poverty wealth, and blear eyes pearls.
"'What art thou driving at, Sancho? Curses on thee!' said Don Quixote. "'For when thou takest to stringing proverbs and sayings together, no one can understand thee but Judas himself, and I wish he had thee. Tell me, thou animal, what dost thou know about nails or wheels or anything else?'
"'Oh, if you don't understand me,' replied Sancho, "'it is no wonder my words are taken for nonsense. But no matter, I understand myself, and I know I have not said anything very foolish in what I have said.' "'Only your worships and your ears always gravelling at everything I say, nay, everything I do.'
"'Cavilling, not gravelling,' said Don Quixote. "'Thou prevaricator of honest language, God confound thee!'
"'Don't find fault with me, your worship,' returned Sancho, "'for you know I have not been bred up at court or trained at Salamanca "'to know whether I am adding or dropping a letter or so in my words. "'Why, God bless me, it's not fair to force a Sayago man to speak like a Toledan. "'Maybe there are Toledans who do not hit it off when it comes to polished talk.'
"'That is true,' said the student, "'for those who have been bred up in the tanneries and the Zocodover "'cannot talk like those who are almost all day pacing the cathedral cloisters, "'and yet they're all Toledans. "'Pure, correct, elegant, and lucid language will be met with "'in men of courtly breeding and discrimination, "'though they may have been born in Majalonda. "'I say of discrimination, because there are many who are not so, "'and discrimination is the grammar of good language, "'if it be accompanied by practice.' "'I, sirs, for my sins, have studied canon law at Salamanca, "'and I rather pique myself on expressing my meaning "'in clear, plain, and intelligible language.'
"'If you did not pique yourself more on your dexterity "'with those foils you carry than on dexterity of tongue,' "'said the other student, "'you would have been head of the degrees where you are now tail.'
"'Look here, Bachelor Cortuelo,' returned the student.
"'You have the most mistaken idea in the world about skill with the sword "'if you think it useless.'
"'It is no idea on my part, but an established truth,' replied Corchuelo. "'And if you wish me to prove it to you by experiment, you have swords there, and it is a good opportunity. I have a steady hand and a strong arm, and these, joined with my resolution, which is not small, will make you confess that I am not mistaken. Dismount, and put in practice your positions and circles and angles and science, for I hope to make you see stars at noonday with my rude, raw swordsmanship, in which, next to God, I place my trust that the man is yet to be born who will make me turn my back, and that there is not one in the world I will not compel to give ground.
As to whether you turn your back or not, I do not concern myself, replied the master of fence, though it might be that your grave would be dug on the spot where you planted your foot the first time. I mean that you would be stretched dead there for despising skill with the sword.
"'We shall soon see,' replied Corchuelo, and getting off his ass briskly, he drew out furiously one of the swords the student carried on his beast. "'It must not be that way,' said Don Quixote at this point. "'I will be the director of this fencing match and judge of this often disputed question.'
And dismounting from Rocinante and grasping his lance, he planted himself in the middle of the road, just as the student, with an easy, graceful bearing and step, advanced towards Corchuelo, who came on against him, darting fire from his eyes, as the saying is. The other two of the company, the peasants, without dismounting from their asses, served as spectators of the mortal tragedy. The cuts, thrusts, downstrokes, backstrokes, and doubles that Corchuelo delivered were past counting, and came thicker than hops or hail. He attacked like an angry lion, but he was met by a tap on the mouth from the button of the student's sword that checked him in the midst of his furious onset, and made him kiss it as if it were a relic— though not as devoutly as relics are and ought to be kissed. The end of it was that the student reckoned up for him by thrusts every one of the buttons of the short cassock he wore, tore the skirts into strips like the tails of a cuttlefish, knocked off his hat twice, and so completely tired him out that in vexation, anger, and rage he took the sword by the hilt and flung it away with such force that one of the peasants that were there, who was a notary, and who went for it, made an affidavit afterwards that he sent it nearly 3/4 of a league, which testimony will serve, and has served, to show and establish with all certainty that strength is overcome by skill. Corchuelo sat down wearied, and Sancho, approaching him, said, "By my faith, Señor Bachelor, if your worship takes my advice, you will never challenge anyone to fence again, only to wrestle and throw the bar, for you have the youth and strength for that. But as for these fencers, as they call them, I have heard say they can put the point of a sword through the eye of a needle."
"I am satisfied with having tumbled off my donkey," said Corchuelo, "and with having had the truth I was so ignorant of proved to me by experience."
And getting up, he embraced the student, and they were better friends than ever. And not caring to wait for the notary who had gone for the sword, as they saw he would be a long time about it, they resolved to push on so as to reach the village of Quiteria, to which they all belonged, in good time. During the remainder of the journey, the student held forth to them on the excellences of the sword, with such conclusive arguments and such figures and mathematical proofs, that all were convinced of the value of the science, and Corchuelo cured of his dogmatism. It grew dark, but before they reached the town it seemed to them all as if there was a heaven full of countless glittering stars in front of it. They heard, too, the pleasant mingled notes of a variety of instruments, flutes, drums, psalteries, pipes, tabors, and timbrels, and as they drew near they perceived that the trees of a leafy arcade that had been constructed at the entrance of the town were filled with lights unaffected by the wind, for the breeze at the time was so gentle that it had not power to stir the leaves on the trees. The musicians were the life of the wedding, wandering through the pleasant grounds in separate bands, some dancing, others singing, others playing the various instruments already mentioned. In short, it seemed as though mirth and gaiety were frisking and gambolling all over the meadow. Several other persons were engaged in erecting raised benches from which people might conveniently see the plays and dances that were to be performed the next day on the spot dedicated to the celebration of the marriage of Camacho the Rich and the obsequies of Basilio. Don Quixote would not enter the village, although the peasant as well as the bachelor pressed him. He excused himself, however, on the grounds amply sufficient in his opinion, that it was the custom of knights-errant to sleep in the fields and woods in preference to towns, even were it under gilded ceilings, and so turned aside a little out of the road, very much against Sancho's will, as the good quarters he had enjoyed in the castle or house of Don Diego came back to his mind. Chapter 20, wherein an account is given of the wedding of Camacho the Rich, together with the incident of Basilio the Poor. Scarce had the fair Aurora given bright Phoebus time to dry the liquid pearls upon her golden locks with the heat of his fervent rays, when Don Quixote, shaking off sloth from his limbs, sprang to his feet and called to his squire Sancho, who was still snoring. Seeing which, Don Quixote, ere he roused him, thus addressed him, "Happy thou above all the dwellers on the face of the earth, that, without envying or being envied, sleepst with tranquil mind, and that neither enchanters persecute nor enchantments affright. Sleep, I say, and will say 100 times, without any jealous thoughts of thy mistress to make thee keep ceaseless vigils, or any cares as to how thou art to pay the debts thou owest, or find tomorrow's food for thyself and thy needy little family, to interfere with thy repose. Ambition breaks not thy rest, nor doth this world's empty pomp disturb thee, for the utmost reach of thy anxiety is to provide for thy ass. Since upon my shoulders thou hast laid the support of thyself, the counterpoise and burden that nature and custom have imposed upon masters, the servant sleeps and the master lies awake thinking how he is to feed him, advance him, and reward him. The distress of seeing the sky turn brazen and withhold its needful moisture from the earth is not felt by the servant but by the master, who in time of scarcity and famine must support him who has served him in times of plenty and abundance." To all this Sancho made no reply, because he was asleep, nor would he have wakened up so soon as he did, had not Don Quixote brought him to his senses with the butt of his lance. He awoke at last, drowsy and hazy, and casting his eyes about in every direction observed,
"There comes, if I don't mistake,
from the quarter of that arcade, a steam and a smell a great deal more like fried rashers than galingale or thyme. A wedding that begins with smells like that, by my faith, ought to be plentiful and unstinting.
"Have done, thou glutton," said Don Quixote. "Come, let us go and witness this bridal, and see what the rejected Basilio does."
"Let him do what he likes," returned Sancho. "Be he not poor, he would marry Quiteria, to make a grand match for himself, and he without a farthing. Is there nothing else? Faith, senor, it's my opinion the poor man should be content with what he can get, and not go looking for dainties in the bottom of the sea. I will bet my arm that Camacho could bury Basilio in reals, and if that be so, as no doubt it is, what a fool Quiteria would be to refuse the fine dresses and jewels Camacho must have given her and will give her, and take Basilio's bar-throwing and sword-play. They won't give a pint of wine at the tavern for a good cast of the bar or a neat thrust of the sword. Talents and accomplishments that can't be turned into money, let Count Dielos have them. But when such gifts fall to one that has hard cash, I wish my condition of life was as becoming as they are. On a good foundation you can raise a good building, and the best foundation in the world is money."
"For God's sake, Sancho," said Don Quixote here, "stop that harangue. It is my belief if thou wert allowed to continue all thou beginnest every instant, thou wouldst have no time left for eating or sleeping, for thou wouldst spend it all in talking."
"If your worship had a good memory," replied Sancho, "you would remember the articles of our agreement before we started from home this last time. One of them was that I was to be let say all I liked, so long as it was not against my neighbour or your worship's authority. And so far, it seems to me, I have not broken the said article."
"I remember no such article, Sancho," said Don Quixote. "And even if it were so, I desire you to hold your tongue and come along, for the instruments we heard last night are already beginning to enliven the valleys again, and no doubt the marriage will take place in the cool of the morning, and not in the heat of the afternoon."
Sancho did as his master bade him, and putting the saddle on Rocinante and the pack-saddle on Dapple, they both mounted and at a leisurely pace entered the arcade. The first thing that presented itself to Sancho's eyes was a whole ox spitted on a whole elm tree, and in the fire at which it was to be roasted there was burning a middling-sized mountain of faggots, and six stewpots that stood round the blaze had not been made in the ordinary mould of common pots, for they were six half-wine jars, each fit to hold the contents of a slaughter-house. They swallowed up whole sheep, and hid them away in their insides without showing any more sign of them than if they were pigeons. Countless were the hares ready-skinned, and the plucked fowls that hung on the trees for burial in the pots. Numberless the wild fowl and game of various sorts suspended from the branches, that the air might keep them cool. Sancho counted more than 60 wineskins of over 6 gallons each, and all filled, as it proved afterwards, with generous wines. There were, besides, piles of the whitest bread, like the heaps of corn one sees on the threshing floors. There was a wall made of cheeses, arranged like open brickwork, and 2 cauldrons full of oil, bigger than those of a dyer's shop, served for cooking fritters, which, when fried, were taken out with 2 mighty shovels and plunged into another cauldron of prepared honey that stood close by. Of cooks and cookmaids there were over 50, all clean, brisk, and blithe. In the capacious belly of the ox were 12 soft little sucking pigs, which, sewn up there, served to give it tenderness and flavour. The spices of different kinds did not seem to have been bought by the pound, but by the quarter, and all lay open to view in a great chest. In short, all the preparations made for the wedding were in rustic style, but abundant enough to feed an army. Sancho observed all, contemplated all, and everything won his heart. The first to captivate and take his fancy were the pots, out of which he would have very gladly helped himself to a moderate pipkinful. Then the wineskins secured his affections, and lastly the produce of the frying-pans, if indeed such imposing cauldrons may be called frying-pans. And unable to control himself or bear it any longer, he approached one of the busy cooks, and civilly but hungrily begged permission to soak a scrap of bread in one of the pots. To which the cook made answer,
"Brother, this is not a day on which hunger is to have any sway, thanks to the rich Camacho. Get down and look about for a ladle, and skim off a hen or two, and much good may they do you."
"I don't see one," said Sancho.
"Wait a bit," said the cook. "Sinner that I am, how particular and bashful you are.
And so saying, he seized a bucket, and plunging it into one of the half-jars, took up 3 hens and a couple of geese, and said to Sancho, "Fall to, friend, and take the edge off your appetite with these skimmings until dinner-time comes."
"I have nothing to put them in," said Sancho.
"Well, then," said the cook, "take spoon and all, for Caracho's wealth and happiness furnish everything."
While Sancho fared thus, Don Quixote was watching the entrance at one end of the arcade of some 12 peasants, all in holiday and gala dress, mounted on 12 beautiful mares with rich, handsome field trappings, and a number of little bells attached to their harnesses, who, marshalled in regular order, ran not one but several courses over the meadow, with jubilant shouts and cries of, "Long live Camacho and Quiteria! He as rich as she is fair, and she the fairest on earth!" Hearing this, Don Quixote said to himself,
"It is easy to see these folk have never seen my Dulcinea del Toboso, for if they had, they would be more moderate in their praises of this Quiteria of theirs."
Shortly after this, several bands of dancers of various sorts began to enter the arcade at different points, and among them one of sword dancers composed of some 24 lads of gallant and high-spirited mien, clad in the finest and whitest of linen, and with handkerchiefs embroidered in various colours with fine silk. And one of those on the mares asked an active youth who led them if any of the dancers had been wounded.
"As yet, thank God, no one has been wounded," said he. "We are all safe and sound."
And he at once began to execute complicated figures with the rest of his comrades, with so many turns and so great dexterity that although Don Quixote was well used to see dances of the same kind, he thought he had never seen any so good as this. He also admired another that came in composed of fair young maidens, none of whom seemed to be under 14 or over 18 years of age, all clad in green stuff, with their locks partly braided, partly flowing loose, but all of such bright gold as to vie with the sunbeams. And over them they wore garlands of jessamine, roses, amaranth, and honeysuckle. At their head were a venerable old man and an ancient dame, more brisk, however, than might have been expected from their years. The notes of a Zamora bagpipe accompanied them, and with modesty in their countenances and in their eyes, and lightness in their feet, they looked the best dancers in the world. Following these, there came an artistic dance of the sort they call speaking dances. It was composed of 8 nymphs in 2 files, with the god Cupid leading one, and Wealth the other, the former furnished with wings, bow, quiver, and arrows, the latter in a rich dress of gold and silk of diverse colours. The nymphs that followed Love bore their names written on white parchment in large letters on their backs. Poetry was the name of the first, Wit of the second, Birth of the third, and Valour of the fourth. Those that followed Wealth were distinguished in the same way. The badge of the first announced Liberality, that of the second, Largesse, the third, Treasure, and the fourth, Peaceful Possession. In front of them all came a wooden castle drawn by 4 wild men, all clad in ivy and hemp stained green, and looking so natural that they nearly terrified Sancho. On the front of the castle, and on each of the 4 sides of its frame, it bore the inscription, Castle of Caution. 4 skilled tabor and flute players accompanied them, and the dance having been opened, Cupid, after executing 2 figures, raised his eyes and bent his bow against a damsel who stood between the turrets of the castle, and thus addressed her.
"I am the mighty god whose sway is potent over land and sea. The heavens above us own me, nay, the shades below acknowledge me. I know not fear, I have my will, whate'er my whim or fancy be. For me there's no impossible. I order, bind, forbid, set free."
Having concluded the stanza, he discharged an arrow at the top of the castle and went back to his place. Wealth then came forward and went through 2 more figures, and as soon as the tabors ceased he said,
"But mightier than Love am I, though Love it be that leads me on, than mine no lineage is more high or older underneath the sun. To use me rightly few know how, to act without me fewer still, for I am Wealth, and I vow for evermore to do thy will."
Wealth retired, and Poetry came forward, and when she had gone through her figures like the others, fixing her eyes on the damsel of the castle, she said, "With many a fanciful conceit, fair lady, winsome poesy, her soul, an offering at thy feet, presents in sonnets unto thee. If thou my homage wilt not scorn, thy fortune, watched by envious eyes, on wings of poesy upborne, shall be exalted to the skies. Poetry withdrew, and on the side of wealth liberality advanced, and after having gone through her figures said, To give, while shunning each extreme, the sparing hand, the over-free, therein consists, so wise men deem, the virtue liberality. But thee, fair lady, to enrich, myself a prodigal I'll prove, a vice not wholly shameful which may find its fair excuse in love. In the same manner all the characters of the two bands advanced and retired, and each executed its figures and delivered its verses, some of them graceful, some burlesque. But Don Quixote's memory, though he had an excellent one, only carried away those that have been just quoted. All then mingled together, forming chains and breaking off again with graceful, unconstrained gaiety. And whenever love passed in front of the castle, he shot his arrows up at it, while wealth broke gilded pellets against it. At length, after they had danced a good while, wealth drew out a great purse, made of the skin of a large brindled cat, and to all appearance full of money, and flung it at the castle, and with the force of the blow the boards fell asunder and tumbled down, leaving the damsel exposed and unprotected. Wealth and the characters of his band advanced, and throwing a great chain of gold over her neck, pretended to take her and lead her away captive. On seeing which, Love and his supporters made as though they would release her, the whole action being to the accompaniment of the tabors, and in the form of a regular dance. The wild men made peace between them, and with great dexterity readjusted and fixed the boards of the castle, and the damsel once more ensconced herself within, and with this the dance wound up, to the great enjoyment of the beholders. Don Quixote asked one of the nymphs who it was that had composed and arranged it. She replied that it was a beneficiary of the town who had a nice taste in devising things of the sort.
"I will lay a wager," said Don Quixote, "that the same bachelor or beneficiary is a greater friend of Camacho's than of Basilio's, and that he is better at satire than at vespers. He has introduced the accomplishments of Basilio and the riches of Camacho very neatly into the dance."
Sancho Panza, who was listening to all this, exclaimed,
"The king is my cock, I stick to Camacho."
"It is easy to see thou art a clown, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "and one of that sort that cry, 'Long life to the conqueror!'"
"I don't know of what sort I am," returned Sancho, "but I know very well I'll never get such elegant skimmings off Basilio's pots as these I have got off Camacho's."
And he showed him the bucket full of geese and hens, and seizing one began to eat with great gaiety and appetite, saying,
"A fig for the accomplishments of Basilio! As much as thou hast, so much art thou worth, and as much as thou art worth, so much hast thou. As a grandmother of mine used to say, there are only two families in the world, the haves and the haven'ts, and she stuck to the haves, and to this day, Señor Don Quixote, people would sooner feel the pulse of have than of no. An ass covered with gold looks better than a horse with a pack saddle. So once more I say, I stick to Camacho, the bountiful skimmings of whose pots are geese and hens, hares and rabbits. But of Basilio's, if any ever come to hand, or even to foot, there'll be only rinsings."
"Hast thou finished thy harangue, Sancho?" said Don Quixote.
"Of course I've finished it," replied Sancho, "because I see your worship takes offence at it. But if it was not for that, there was work enough cut out for 3 days."
"God grant I may see thee dumb before I die, Sancho," said Don Quixote.
"At the rate we're going," said Sancho, "I'll be chewing clay before your worship dies. And then, maybe, I'll be so dumb that I'll not say a word until the end of the world, or at least till the day of judgment."
"Even should that happen, O Sancho," said Don Quixote, "thy silence will never come up to all thou hast talked, art talking, and wilt talk all thy life. Moreover, it naturally stands to reason that my death will come before thine, so I never expect to see thee dumb, not even when thou art drinking or sleeping. And that is the utmost I can say."
"In good faith, señor," replied Sancho, "there's no trusting that fleshless one, I mean death, who devours the lamb as soon as the sheep and, as I have heard our curate say, treads with equal foot upon the lofty towers of kings and the lowly huts of the poor.
That lady is more mighty than dainty. She is no way squeamish. She devours all and is ready for all and fills her saddlebags with people of all sorts, ages and ranks. She is no reaper that sleeps out the noontide. At all times she is reaping and cutting down, as well the dry grass as the green. She never seems to chew, but bolts and swallows all that is put before her, for she has a canine appetite that is never satisfied. And though she has no belly, she shows she has a dropsy and is athirst to drink the lives of all that live, as one would drink a jug of cold water.
"Say no more, Sancho," said Don Quixote at this. "Don't try to better it and risk a fall. For in truth what thou hast said about death in thy rustic phrase is what a good preacher might have said. I tell thee, Sancho, if thou hadst discretion equal to thy mother wit, thou mightst take a pulpit in hand and go about the world preaching fine sermons." "He preaches well who lives well," said Sancho, "and I know no more theology than that."
"Nor needst thou," said Don Quixote. "But I cannot conceive or make out how it is that, the fear of God being the beginning of wisdom, thou, who art more afraid of a lizard than him, knowest so much."
"Pass judgment on your chivalry, senor," returned Sancho, "and don't set yourself up to judge of other men's fears or braveries, for I am as good a fearer of God as my neighbours. But leave me to dispatch these skimmings, for all the rest is only idle talk that we shall be called to account for in the other world."
And so saying, he began a fresh attack on the bucket, with such a hearty appetite that he aroused Don Quixote's, who no doubt would have helped him had he not been prevented by what must be told farther on. Chapter 21, in which Camacho's wedding is continued, with other delightful incidents. While Don Quixote and Sancho were engaged in the discussion set forth in the last chapter, they heard loud shouts and a great noise, which were uttered and made by the men on the mares as they went at full gallop, shouting, to receive the bride and bridegroom, who were approaching with musical instruments and pageantry of all sorts around them, and accompanied by the priest and the relatives of both, and all the most distinguished people of the surrounding villages. When Sancho saw the bride, he exclaimed, "By my faith, she is not dressed like a country girl, but like some fine court lady. Egad, as well as I can make out, the necklace she wears is rich coral, and her green Cuenca stuff is 30-pile velvet, and then the white linen trimming. By my oath, but it's satin. Look at her hands. Jet rings on them. May I never have luck if they're not gold rings and real gold, and set with pearls as white as a curdled milk, and every one of them worth an eye of one's head. Horse and baggage, what hair she has! If it's not a wig, I never saw longer or fairer all the days of my life. See how bravely she bears herself, and her shape. Wouldn't you say she was like a walking palm tree, loaded with clusters of dates? For the trinkets she has hanging from her hair and neck look just like them. Well, I swear in my heart she is a brave lass and fit to pass over the banks of Flanders." Don Quixote laughed at Sancho's boorish eulogies and thought that, saving his lady Dulcinea del Toboso, he had never seen a more beautiful woman. The fair Quiteria appeared somewhat pale, which was, no doubt, because of the bad night brides always pass dressing themselves out for their wedding on the morrow. They advanced towards a theatre that stood on one side of the meadow, decked with carpets and boughs, where they were to plight their troth, and from which they were to behold the dances and plays. But at the moment of their arrival at the spot they heard a loud outcry behind them, and a voice exclaiming,
"Wait a little, ye is inconsiderate as you are hasty!"
At these words all turned round, and perceived that the speaker was a man clad in what seemed to be a loose black coat, garnished with crimson patches like flames. He was crowned, as was presently seen, with a crown of gloomy cypress, and in his hand he held a long staff. As he approached he was recognized by everyone as the gay Basilio, and all waited anxiously to see what would come of his words, in dread of some catastrophe in consequence of his appearance at such a moment. He came up at last, weary and breathless, and planting himself in front of the bridal pair, drove his staff, which had a steel spike at the end, into the ground, and with a pale face and eyes fixed on Quiteria, he thus addressed her in a hoarse, trembling voice.
"Well dost thou know, ungrateful Quiteria, that according to the holy law we acknowledge, so long as thou live thou canst take no husband, nor art thou ignorant either that,
in my hopes that time and my own exertions would improve my fortunes. I have never failed to observe the respect due to thy honour. But thou, casting behind thee all thou owest to my true love, would surrender what is mine to another whose wealth serves to bring him not only good fortune, but supreme happiness. And now to complete it, not that I think he deserves it, but inasmuch as heaven is pleased to bestow it upon him, I will, with my own hands, do away with the obstacle that may interfere with it, and remove myself from between you. Long live the rich Camacho! Many a happy year may he live with the ungrateful Kitten.